Welcome back to the OIS Podcast. This week, Ashley Brissett, MD, leads a panel of experts through a dynamic discussion held during our recent Dry Eye Innovation Showcase about the challenges of managing this disease. Let's listen to what the dry eye experts had to share.
Hi, I'm Dr. Ashley Brissett. I'm a cataract, cornea, and refractive surgeon at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medicine in Manhattan. And I'm so delighted to present to you this incredible group of eye specialists that are going to be talking everything that you need to know about dry eye disease. We're just so happy to welcome them all here. Rather than me trying to give introductions, I would like them each to introduce themselves. And I also want, if each of you, when you do introduce yourself, can tell us why you're interested in dry eye. Just one sentence, you know, one thing about what got you interested in this subspecialty within ophthalmology. So maybe we'll start first with Dr. Matossian.
Ashley, first, thank you very much for inviting me. This is an amazing opportunity. I'm Cynthia Matossian from Matossian Eye Associates. And my current focus is exclusively dry eye disease and ocular surface disease. I stopped doing refractive cataract surgery about a year ago. And the reason I'm passionate about dry eye disease is because it actually is so critically important, not only for sight, but comfort and just the way that we feel in our eyes all the awake hours.
Yeah, I completely agree. And Dr. Alzaga, next.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you, OIS, for this invitation. I'm delighted to be amongst these experts and colleagues of ours. My name is Ana Alzaga. I'm from Weill Cornell Medicine as well, just like Ashley. And as a comprehensive ophthalmologist and a cornea specialist, I find that dry eye patients can sometimes be complex and can present a therapeutic challenge for us, especially when we've discussed with them and we've tackled and implemented several different therapies, and they still have symptoms. So I think that there's a really interesting area that does require ongoing and continuous research and innovation. So this is, for me, definitely an area of interest.
That's wonderful. And Dr. Tong, yourself?
Thanks, Ashley, for the invitation, and thank you to the panelists. So I'm Rahul Tonk. I'm a cornea specialist at the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute in Miami, where I also serve as an associate medical director and co-director cornea fellowship here. And I became interested in dry eye, I think, mostly because I found that so many dry eye patients were neglected. And I kind of felt this attraction to this kind of underdog condition and seeing how I could kind of crack the nut on those cases and help patients have a breakthrough. But the other big one for me was, you know, dry eye is that common thread through everything we do surgically, from cornea surgery to cataract surgery to refractive. And so really nailing it really helps you have those great outcomes across the board.
Yeah, I love that. I completely agree with you there. And Dr. Perriman?
Hi, Ashley. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here with all of you incredible experts. It's really an honor for me. Thank you, OIS, as well, for arranging this. For me, dry disease is very compelling on an intellectual level, on a scientific level, on a clinical level. I find that each individual patient is their own complex mix of factors and tangled ball of yarn, and I find incredible intellectual satisfaction in figuring out the different components, teasing them apart, and yet we still don't have enough options for some of these patients. So the innovative part also keeps me super engaged. I also suffer from dry eye myself, so I'm always looking for new solutions as well. So rich, innovative space and wonderful way to help patients' quality of life.
That's really interesting. You say you're a personal sufferer of dry eye as well. I say I talk about it so much that I feel like I give myself dry eye sometimes. So I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
And Dr. Rappaport?
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Ashley, so much for inviting me and to OIS and to all the panelists. I'm Una Rappaport. I'm a cornea, cataract, refractive surgeon and founder and director of Manhattan Eye. And I just find that the sheer prevalence of dry eye is so vast. And it doesn't just present as, quote, dry eye. You know, somebody comes in with fluctuating vision, didn't even know they had dry eye. And I find that when you explain to patients that it's this this condition that's the underlying root of their problem and not something else that they thought, they're almost relieved to know that many people suffer from this, including some panelists, and that it's common, that there's very readily available treatments and then some other ones down the road. So I find that when you make that small improvement, patients just are so thankful.
I completely agree. And lastly, but not least, and really not needing any introduction, is the infamous Dr. Kopecky. But I will let you introduce yourself here as well.
Thanks, Ashley. I like that. It's infamous. I think it fits perfectly. It's an honor to get to be part of this group. I practice as a director of cornea and external disease at Kentucky Eye Institute. I'm associate professor at the University of Pikeville College of Optometry. So my background is in optometry. I love to say that I knew dry eye was going to be something, you know, wonderful to be part of, you know, 20 years later. But the truth is I did a medical cornea fellowship under Dan Dury in Kansas City back in 1994. And I stayed on. And a few years into it, we had so many dry eye patients that it was either you had this role or you didn't really have a role in the practice. So I took on the role. And it was frustrating in the beginning. I can't say I had a high success rate, but there was this challenge, to be able to try and see what we could do for these patients. And they were, as many have said today, you know, desperate patients and really looking for solutions. And that challenge really motivated me to try and learn all I could to try and figure this out. Now, today, I'm happy to say we're getting success, but everything that was said tonight is so accurate. It is very complex, very challenging disease, but it's a great thing to dedicate a career to because you can have such an impact on patients' lives.
I completely agree with that. And it's interesting that you brought up how much even our understanding of the field has changed, because when I think about it, I think some of the biggest messaging in dry eye disease is that we really need to understand that it's an inflammatory process. And that's the underlying kind of root cause of patient symptoms and clinically why they present the way that they do. And if we want to help them improve both clinically and symptomatically, we need to target that underlying inflammation. So I kind of wonder, how do you view dry eye disease as a disease state?
Well, I'll jump in. You're so right, Ashley. There are many components to dry eye disease. I agree with so many of the comments that all of you have made. It is very complex. And I too like the fact that it's not cookie cutter approach. Every patient has a different nuanced version of this multifactorial disease. But at the kernel of it, there is an inflammatory process. There's a dysregulation of the homeostasis, it's not there anymore. So the inflammatory cascade kicks in with different speed levels. You know, some have this indolent kind of smoldering amount of irritating inflammation, and some people have these huge flares, really uncomfortable. So we do need to treat with inflammation in mind, but there are so many coexisting factors with eyelids, lashes, et cetera, that I'm sure we'll get into, that we also have to address those.
You know, I'll add one comment. Dr. Matosian's right on. You know, Cynthia hit it perfectly, how it is such a characteristic of this disease. And no matter which type of dry eye you identify, whether it's an evaporative form where you have to take care of the meibomian glands and the obstruction, and oftentimes, as Cynthia said, the blepharitis, whether it's, you know, Demodex or whether it's staph or seborrheic, you also have inflammation and then a disrupted tear film. If you look at a mucin-deficient form of dry eye, you have to enhance the goblet cell functioning, but you still have inflammation to control. And if it's aqueous deficient, you obviously have a tear volume issue, but inflammation is the hallmark. So the point being, that's probably the only consistent component across all forms of dry eye is that inflammatory component.
Yeah, completely. Dr. Pearman, I know you have a real scientific background. What are your thoughts?
It makes my heart happy to hear all this talk about inflammation and appreciation for inflammation. I was a molecular immunobiologist prior to medical school. I worked on Enbrel at Immunex before it went to market. And so this idea that you can modulate inflammation with elegance and precision has been in my mind for a very long time. So I love the recognition that there's this cacophony of inflammation, and that eye may not be red, but rest assured, there is all kinds of inflammatory cytokine T cell mischief running amok. And there's a golden opportunity to engage in that thought process and utilize that anti-inflammatory immunomodulatory mindset as a foundational basic place to start.
And I have to, you know, agreeing with everything that's been said, which is spot on. You know, I have to also appreciate the involvement in industry in recognizing the inflammation as a key portion of this. And, you know, practically speaking, we have all of these new tools that we have at our disposal, cyclosporine, lifitegrast, topical steroids, and some which are now on label for the treatment of dry eye flares. And so we know that inflammation is there, and we now have the tools to be able to treat it, and also the assays to recognize inflammation in the office when we evaluate patients. So to get their buy-in on dry eye as inflammatory disease, we can assess for the presence of the matrix metalloproteinase enzyme. We can identify tear film hyperosmolarity. And so I think it's all part of this approach, you know, and I'm glad to hear Laura, you know, talk a little bit about the science piece of it as well, you know, interested to hear more, but that's, I think, where this is headed. It's kind of the more that we can treat it scientifically and have patients then buy into that scientific component to it, I think the better that we can collaborate. Of course, with the small caveat that there will always be some trickiness to it from the sense that there's a neurosensory component and it may not fit into our, you know, zeros and ones algorithmics. But in general, yeah, agree with everything that's been said about inflammation as definitely a principal component.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so important, as you were mentioning, about that neurosensory component. It's so important to treat it early and to treat the inflammation early. So if we do now have this broader understanding of inflammation as being the root cause of dry eye disease, I just wonder, why aren't more eye care providers prescribing anti-inflammatory therapies for dry eye?
I think about this all the time. I think we know so much about the pathophysiology and MMP9 and the all the other cytokines that are the root of this inflammatory condition. And I just wonder why, you know, so many people say, no, I'm fine with just using the lubricating drops. I don't want medications for this. So I think people, for whatever reason, either through messaging or through their own preconceptions, both patients and some physicians think it's not, quote, a real condition, right? And in the same way that, okay, you have dry lips, just use some chapstick, right? They sort of think, well, it's not really a real disease. So I think that's really the reason why, you know, so many patients are sort of allergic to using all of the anti-inflammatory medications, doxycycline, lifitegrast, cyclosporine. We have so many great tools on the market, both on label and some off label as well. And some of the steroids that, you know, one of which is now FDA approved for dry eye. That I think it's really all about messaging and education, like Dr. Matossian said, really educating patients, you know, about the underlying root and that this really truly comes down to an inflammatory disease.
Yeah, especially now that we have some of those markers, as you were mentioning, Rahul, that we can show patients, you know, we can see the inflammation and we can test for it. And that's something we can show them. And Anna, do you have a different opinion coming from an academic background? What are kind of your thoughts about why maybe we're not all prescribing anti-inflammatories for dry eye disease?
I would agree and echo what everybody has mentioned so far. I think this is evolving, and I think it's evolving not only for eye care providers, but also for the patients themselves. They're more and more informed. And they come in asking many times for these medications. I agree with Dr. Rappaport that sometimes they're a little bit hesitant to start a quote-unquote medication, and they prefer to continue with just ocular lubricants. But at the same time, when those are not working, in many instances, due to the underlying inflammation being the main component of the various types of dry eye, we need to do something more. And just like you mentioned, Ashley, it's important to act, not leave it as a last resort, but rather think about inflammation and how to tackle and appropriately treat inflammation early on, especially in those patients that may have perhaps an autoimmune condition that may be triggering also this inflammation.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And a few people have already mentioned this, so I kind of want to touch on it. We're talking about, you know, flare-ups for dry eye disease and then longer-term treatment for dry eye disease, and both of that being inflammatory mediated. So I just wonder, what is the role for medications for flare-up versus long-term management? And if you have any thoughts there?
I would just say that, just like Raul mentioned, we've been really lucky to have now many, many tools to our disposal, not only from a diagnostic perspective, but also from the therapeutic perspective.
I think, you know, inflammation does not stay even keel. Mm-hmm. There are triggers, and each person may have a different set of triggers. They could be mild or pretty strong. And all of a sudden, you might be going along with your kind of maintenance level of inflammation, which may or may not be adequately controlled with your chronic maintenance therapy. And then all of a sudden, you get this spike. And the level of the spike can vary depending on the trigger, depending on the amount of exposure to that trigger. It could be a little rolling hill like the Poconos, or it could be Montana. So accordingly, you have to treat differently. And so you need an additional medication on top of the maintenance therapy to treat these flares. And fortunately, we do have a steroid now on label, FDA approved for these flares.
Yes. There's a lot of analogies. Those are great answers. I mean, you think about asthma, you think about rheumatoid arthritis. I mean, these are inflammatory conditions that are just prone to flare up. So to think that, you know, a progressive inflammatory condition like dry eye wouldn't be is missing things. And I know I loved a couple of the answers earlier too, Dr. Rapport's answer about, you know, how we think of maybe this as a benign treatment. Payers certainly think of it that way, a benign condition in dry eye like chapped lips. And yet, it's, once we start realizing it's a progressive condition, that the damage that we see to meibomian glands or lacrimal glands or goblet cells is from that chronic inflammation, we almost realize we have an obligation to control that. And triggers are different. You know, in Lexington, my biggest time of flare-ups for my patients is during the March and April when the allergy season's high. In other places, it might be during winter. And so we can't, you know, there's no consistency. Like Dr. Matossian said, it really depends on the situation, internal hormone regulation, nerve regulation, environmental factors. We have to just know that most patients with chronic dry disease are going to have episodic flares.
And I sometimes put that in the hand of the patient as well, where I can say to them, you know, we have what we're doing kind of day to day to manage your disease. And then we're going to start to find a regimen that we know works for you. And if we know that you have a flare, what you respond to, then they can start to take control over their own disease as well. And it feels like they're playing a part in their disease management, which I think people do appreciate.
I'm so glad you said that, Ashley, because that, you know, that collaboration is so key. I mean, patients have dry eye flares. I think everyone has spoken out to that. The thing that telemedicine and this era of COVID has had me rethink, and many people in the office rethink, is, you know, how often do I want to be bringing a patient back to the office? And that whole dry eye population, you think about how frequent these flares are and how many phone calls you get, how many return visits you have to the office. Right now, we think about the pandemic as being a restriction to those in-office visits. But now you think more broadly and you say, okay, somebody, if they're elderly, they don't drive, they've got to have somebody take off from work to bring them in to sit in my waiting room to, you know, their time is valuable for something that we can predict is going to happen. So, you know, like you said, Ashley, if we can kind of collaborate ahead of time, and I really think that in a sense, we want to move away from the paternalism of saying that, okay, well, I'm going to hold these flare medications in my pocket and prescribe them, you know, when I think you're responsible enough to deserve them, mm-hmm. is kind of backwards. You know, it's like, let's say that the patient's got the issue, they know when they need it. And you've advised them, let's say topical corticosteroids, for example, you know, you've advised them as to the frequency that they may be able to use them with or without a call. And now that we have something on label, you can feel potentially a little bit more free on that.
I'm so glad you brought up that socioeconomic cost of dry eye disease. I think it really gets underplayed to your point of, you know, the caregiver or the adult child needing to bring the elderly parent in for clinic. There's a huge socioeconomic cost of just that alone, mm-hmm. of the lost productivity, not to mention the lost productivity from the dry eye itself, not only in the elderly and retired, but in the younger working demographic as well. There was a fascinating study by Essen Akpek published last year showing that dry eye disease results in a statistically significant reduction in silent reading speed. And that translates into challenges with workplace productivity. So I think when we're talking about the socioeconomic impact of all this, even though we only spend $3.84 billion with a B And that's, then this is old data, 2011, on what third-party payers are paying for dry eye disease. The total societal cost is $50 billion. And that's, to me, that's a call to action. We need to do a better job of heading this off ahead of time and helping offload that $46.3 billion on the other end of things, so that we can have a more productive, more comfortable visual work performance, work life, life satisfaction, you name it.
Yeah, that's such an important consideration. And I think it's something that often goes kind of overlooked. You know, we don't think it's so much to bring somebody back into the office, and but it really does have quite an effect on them. And so we've spoken a little bit about these medications that we have available. So we have cyclosporins in two different doses. We have lifitegrast. We now have on-label use of corticosteroids. And I wonder what in-office procedures that you're also offering to your patients, because I think this is a subset that's really grown in the past number of years. And I'd love to hear from those of you both in academics and also in private practice and how you incorporate that into your dry eye armamentarium for your patients.
I'll start on that one. I'm in Seattle in private practice, and we opened in the middle of COVID last year, a fresh start, new clinic. And we do telemedicine, the advanced diagnostics in office. And our strategy is hunt for it, look for it, treat it. And so if I see, a positive MMP9, a positive osmolarity, staining on the cornea, if I see Demodex, if I see allergic conjunctivitis, all of these things are calling my attention, and I need to address them all as part of that comprehensive care of the dry eye patient, because I'm looking for those comorbidities and those drivers of inflammation and trying to get them under control. So we'll do deep in-office cleaning. We will do a manual bluff exfoliation. We will do IPL frequently. We'll do radio frequency treatments, mask and probing. We do a lot of in-office actual interventions and treatments. Thermal meibomian gun expression. There's three different modalities, and we will offer those as well.
And I think to treat dry eye disease, you almost need both. In my opinion, you need the in-office procedures. That's like the deep clean using the dental hygiene model. That's the hygienist, getting to the root problem, cleaning out the meibomian glands, removing the scurf from the lid margin. And then there are at-home remedies as well that the patient may have to do, whether it's with a heated mask or lid scrubs or an automated lid scrub or whatever it might be at home. And then there's the pharmaceutical approach. So really, it's this incredible mix. And how do you balance it out? And of course, there's a financial component to it, where the patient sometimes says, I just can't afford more, because so much of these treatments are, of course, cash pay and never covered by insurance.
Yeah. And anyone from academics, do you have any kind of opinions about incorporating this into your practice?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm fortunate to be amongst, a group of very like-minded colleagues, and we've come together and, you know, invested in having protocols and different equipment to do some of these in-office treatments. I think that, having that interventional mindset toward dry eye is so critical. Maybe that's, biased in terms of how patients are coming to me frequently. There are patients that are seeking consultation specifically for surface disease. So by that point, they've tried a lot of different things and they're looking for something more. So as has been mentioned, I think having some element, if you're going to treat a lot of dry eye, having some element of thermal pulsation is key. Having some mechanism by which you can exfoliate either in the office or at home, or products that you sell, the lid margin is key. I do believe a lot in meibomian gland probing for the severe obstructive meibomian gland disease, and that is helpful. Other in-office procedures, you can consider things that you might do for conjunctiva chalasis, like grid cautery or excision with the amniotic membrane in the operating room, amniotic membrane, bandage contact lenses. I mean, there's a punctal occlusion. There's so many things we can do as interventionalists for dry eye now. And, Cynthia brought up an important point about finding that balance between what insurance and medical is going to cover and what the patient's going to come out of pocket for. And that does, I think, just as we see in people adopting premium lens technology, including toric lenses and multifocal lenses, there's there's always going to be some hesitation to adopting good technology because you're asking the patient to come out of pocket. And the same is true, I think, for dry eye care. It's nice to be able to have some balance of things you can do medical directly through the insurance, and then, you know, potentially procedural based, but still under medical. Like, for example, conjunctivocalasis repair or cautery, punctal occlusion, bandage contact lens placement. There's so many different things. Probing, you know, to some degree, there's some gray area in billing and coding, but some do code that. And, you know, there are things you can do. You shouldn't have to feel like everything is cash pay. But I think, you know, that's the way that we're headed, is more and more interventional care for dry eye.
I agree with you. And it's interesting you say that, thinking about it in an academic perspective. I'm also in academic medicine. And what I've started to offer now is a specialty dry eye clinic day where I have access to that technology. I have extra support for people that can help us facilitate the technology for patients that want to come in and have a microguelphro exfoliation or have thermal pulsation at the same time of their appointments. So I think offering that is becoming almost a part of this dry eye disease and treating it as a subspecialty. So not just thinking of yourself as a comprehensive ophthalmologist, but on that day, I'm a dry eye disease specialist and I'm there, you know, offering the most advanced technology to our patients and thinking about it in that mindset. That being said, when I started this, I used to offer dry eye disease questionnaires to every single patient that came in. And I had this wonderful idea of running these research studies based on the data I was collecting. And then I'd give them another questionnaire when they came for their follow-up and see how their symptoms improved. And all of that went by the wayside. I actually don't use questionnaires anymore because I found I just would ask really directed questions of my patients and get much better information. But I'd love to hear from all of you. Are any of you doing questionnaires? Are you not using them? How do you assess your dry eye disease state in your patients?
I think a lot of it really depends on the clinic situation. Like you said, in terms of, you know, in my clinic, I mean, I have an advanced patient clinic. I have over, you know, 650 positive diagnosed Sjogren's syndrome patients. And the only reason I know that is we had a study. They had the kind of minor data, and that's how many were in the database. So in that clinic, I'm exactly like yours. It's very directed. I kind of know the patients coming in. 99% are referred in. You know, it's just going to be very directed about the time of their symptoms, when are they worse, morning, night, severity, those sort of things, how long they've been dealing with it. Try to gauge what's there and then test for it. But in a primary care setting, which I get to participate in once in a while, I find that there's so many patients that are just never discovered, that truly just go through the system wondering why they're not feeling comfortable in a contact lens, don't even bring it up, that you have to kind of start finding ways to. I found that, you know, if you could have the front office desk staff just ask like five simple questions, you know, how do your eyes feel? Are they gritty, dry? How do they look? Are they red, irritated? Do you have fluctuating vision? Do you have the urge to, or are you using artificial tears? And how much time do you spend on digital devices? We started uncovering huge amounts of dry eye in some of our clinics within like the Kepler organization that we never would have discovered, or a speed questionnaire. And even if you want to be conservative, consider an 8 and above rather than 6. It's amazing how much is missed in clinics that are much more like ours that are set up for this. I think it makes much more sense to be direct like you are and to kind of focus on these pivotal kind of questions that help direct us in terms of the diagnosis. But I don't want to underestimate the potential that's out there in those practices that are more comprehensive. They've never really looked for those patients, and they could do it at the very first call, at the check-in, and with questionnaires for that reason.
Absolutely. Dr. Rappaport, I know you are in private practice and independent practice. And so do you have time to do questionnaires with all your patients? What's your approach?
What's really interesting you ask. I used to, similarly to you, do them on basically everyone. And then COVID hit, and it's practically time that a patient is sitting in their waiting room filling this out, right? You could, you know, send it to them ahead of time and do it electronically that way. But I found that even just aside from the practical time component of it, I found that it didn't change my management all that much. What the patient told me and their signs guided my management a lot more than a 50 on the OSDI, a 30. And I also found that they just weren't that consistent. Even if I gave a patient an OSDI one day and the next, even without implementing new intervention, it varied. And we assume that it will vary depending on many, you know, time components, environmental, et cetera. But I just found that it didn't really change my management. Patients found it time consuming and a little bit annoying, honestly. And, you know, ultimately there are other tools, whether objective, like MMP9, TRL's molarity, or just subjective, like you said, directed targeting, targeted questions that are straight to the point. And I think those are a little more direct.
I think there are two different paths for questionnaires, Ashley. I'm so glad we're talking about this topic. Like Paul said, if it's an established dry eye clinic and the patient is coming in seeking your consultative services, I don't think you need a questionnaire unless you're doing a clinical study. Whereas for the average eye care practitioner, it's a discovery tool. So that's where they are finding these patients, because otherwise they may not know to ask the proper questions. That's where I think there's a difference.
I just want to say that I might be a bit of an outlier here, but we've taken the opposite approach and expanded our questionnaire outreach. We converted completely to JOT forms, which are HIPAA compliant. And you can send the patient the link. They can complete it quickly on their phone. So we actually cast a broader net than we even used to. So I'm capturing speed, OSDI, DEQ5. I'm asking about photophobia, history of migraine, headache disorder. I'm fishing for those neurosensory subtypes of dry eye that I'm looking for. I'm trying to tease it out. There's sections on there about what they're using on their face to remove their makeup at the end of the day. What skincare products do they use? So I'm ferreting out. I actually took the opposite approach. I've cast a broader net. We're a referral center for complex dry eye disease. Some patients self-refer, but I want to know more about each individual patient. But to your point, in follow-ups, I tend to ask the more directed questions.
That's interesting. I like that there's differing opinions on this. And Dr. Alzaghi, your clinic is literally down the hall from mine. What are you doing? I'd love to know.
Yeah, thank you for asking. I've been learning a tremendous amount from all the different perspectives from my colleagues today. In my case, I don't use them currently. Even though they have a really valuable role in assessing the severity of dry eye and teasing out, just like Dr. Perryman said, the different subtypes of dry eye patients. I like to hear it from the patient directly. I like for the patient to tell me what are his or her symptoms that they're affecting their daily living, for me to better understand how I can best help him or her. And then and as a whole, like the patient's dry eye as a whole, and then with in conjunction with the patient, come up with their tailored treatment plan. As we well know, dry eye has so many layers to it that it's important to, just like Raul also mentioned, that it's important to have this sort of rapport with a patient in order to have a successful outcome and result. So certainly to me, as seeing the patient as a whole and be able to tackle their dry eye.
And one more point on this topic, you know, Paul and Cynthia, I think you were the first to say about using the questionnaires in the primary clinics as a sort of discovery tool. And maybe less so, if I heard it right, in the dry eye specialty clinics. And I think, Ashley, you're being bashful, because you and Priya Gupta and Chris Starr, I think, wrote a paper that changed the way many of us think about discovering dry eye in a practice full of patients that are presenting for cataract evaluations. And so being able to pick up those patients now and say, you know, my technicians, actually, they're prompted by me as to whether I need to optimize the ocular surface in this patient, particularly if they're a patient that has, you know, very particular refractive demands. You know, we can say the moment that they specifically get asked if they have dry eye or discomfort to any degree, and if they do, then I do ask them to complete, you know, brief dry eye workup. I do the staining myself, but they do a Schirmer, we do an MMP9, and I have them take a speed questionnaire. And that's for, you know, that kind of all comers for cataract surgery.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think the utility of using some of that in the clinic, as you mentioned, is asking directed questions, especially about fluctuating vision if they're presenting for cataract surgery. That's a big one for me. And then also using some of those in-office point-of-care tests like the tear osmolarity and the MMP9 to really catch those patients that symptomatically might be in denial, but we know clinically that there are signs there. And it's easy for me to look and say your eyes look dry, but if I can show them the inflammatory markers, I feel like I get a lot more buy-in for them doing the preoperative care that they need to get the best postoperative outcome. So, you know, we've talked a lot about dry eye and we've kind of skirted around the issue of blepharitis, which is so concurrent with dry eye. So I'd love to hear kind of your approach about blepharitis and really about Demodex blepharitis, because I think this is something that goes underdiagnosed in the dry eye sphere. And we now are also starting to have some options available specifically for treatment for Demodex. So I'd love to hear some thoughts on this.
Well, I'll be happy to start. You know, these little mites are on all of us, but some patients, for multiple reasons, have a proliferation of these Demodex mites. So in this, the almost the pathognomonic sign are the circular dandruffs or those kind of curled debris, almost like calamari at the base of the lashes, you know? That's how I tell my patients. It's like little calamari at the base of the lashes. And everybody kind of picture
it on a stick.
So, you know, when we look for it, and sometimes they're also misdirected lashes, often the lashes are kind of in erratic directions, not the normal curve to them. And when we have the patient look down a little bit, we can see these ringlets, these circular dandruff at the base of the lashes. And when I see that, I mean, up until now, basically it's discussing it with a patient and I've recommended tea tree oil product. But soon we're going to have an eye drop that will paralyze the CNS system of these little mites, kills them. And it's a BID use for 6 weeks. And perhaps these patients may have to be retreated twice a year. So that's going to make our treatment so much better and more effective. And Laura, I know you treat Demodex with IPL. So do I. So maybe you want to share about your treatment approach.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's Demodex. I get a nefarious pleasure out of, I'll save a house spider all day long, but not that eight-legged bugger, right? So this is, but as clinically, we see, we teach them to do scrubs. You have to have 4-terpenol, the active ingredient in tea tree oil, which is approximately half a full-strength tea tree oil at 5% to actually get a demicidal effect. And so that's above the tolerability limit for many of our patients. So we'll offer a home care, a deep cleaning in the office. We published a paper in January last year showing direct Demodex death from IPL therapy. So we'll offer IPL as well. And then we'll have them maintain the effect at home with a mechanical eyelid cleaning device. And I suspect what's happening is the Demodex don't like the vibration. And that helps them helps to keep them under control. But to your point, like it's hard to eradicate them. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very excited to have another arrow in the quiver to address this creepy crawly issue.
We started working with low light level therapy a little bit too. It's been a new thing we've added where we use a blue and then a red. And I'm fascinated after 2 treatments, you could just pretty much just brush off the carcasses. On the second. So that's a newer, and of course we apply the IPL with that as well. So there's these new things that have become, like you said, Laura and Cynthia, kind of this out of necessity because it's so difficult to get it controlled. And patients have a tough time with scrubs simply because they are in the lash follicles. They are within the meibomian glands. It's hard to get that out. So I think it's a major culprit. I think it's the number one reason we are seeing many of these recalcitrant forms of evaporative dry eye that aren't going away when you start to look closely. And I agree with Cynthia that, you know, that slight look down, every one of us has had that aha moment when we first saw it, and we can always remember, oh, that's Demodex. And I'm excited too about a topical. I think it's going to be significant. I think kind of like dry eye, they say the market actually, CBD codes or identification tripled after we had a dry eye product. I expect that's going to be the same thing for Demodex blepharitis. We're going to find a tripling of its prevalence just because we're going to start knowing to look for it because we finally have a treatment when TP3 becomes available.
My Demodex blepharitis patients have a lot better compliance than my just regular blepharitis patients, and that's because I show everyone a photo of it, and they, you know, they're aghast at first and go, oh no, but you know, I'm clean, you know, and I have to explain it has nothing to do with that, and it's nothing you're doing. These mites just live on our eyelids and they cause all of this damage, including the aqueous deficiency. So up until now, you know, mechanical debridement, I don't have all these fancy devices in my office yet. So a lot of Clearidex. I manually express a lot of glands as well for both types of blepharitis patients. And yeah, it's nice to know that there is a drop on the horizon that has sort of a clear cut time frame. Because when you tell patients, well, you're going to be on this for sort of an indefinite amount of time, that's hard for patients to swallow. So I think a concrete time frame is something that is going to increase compliance even more and hopefully eradicate the mites.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm always blown away, even, you know, just by the amount of scurf that's at the base of the eyelashes that our patients have. I always kind of jokingly say women are fairly good at cleansing their eyelashes because we're mostly taking our makeup off before bed. But you do see it a lot where you just have this kind of scurf that patients say, yeah, it does get a little bit crusty sometimes. And patients are always very surprised when you mention to them that they should be washing and cleansing their eyelashes. Like, I'm always surprised that they're surprised that that's something that they need to be doing. And I think dentists have done a wonderful job of telling people to brush their teeth twice a day. And in the eye care community, we're still trying to get this message out that you actually need to cleanse the skin around your eyelids and lashes. So I'd love to hear from you guys. Why do you think that messaging isn't fully out there yet? Or do you think people just don't believe it? Where's the disconnect?
Well, only brush and floss the teeth you want to keep, right? So I think the same can be said for our meibomian glands. Only, you know, take care of the ones you want to keep. It was interesting you mentioned about the makeup removal and how that may be helpful in some of these lid hygiene situations, Demodex situations. It turns out the survivability of Demodex is 3 days. In a waxy, oily substrate such as mascara. And so failure, that starts to make sense. Our own research showed that speed scores are much higher in people who don't take off their makeup, statistically significantly higher. And now seeing that Demodex survives quite well in waxy, oily substances such as mascara, it starts to make sense why removing your makeup may help reduce your symptoms, because now we're removing the protective coating or whatever it is happening there. But my jaw hit the floor when I read that paper about Demodex survivability in different cosmetics.
I wonder if, you know, if dentistry, you know, you start at such an early age, understanding the importance of brushing, it just becomes habitual when it's early. You know, people don't discover, you know, this blepharitis. I don't think we've been good at identifying collarettes early on in our career of knowing what that was. So I think that we're trying to teach a habit in it at a time when that's not habitual. So it's a little more of a challenge, which goes back to what everybody talked about so well today, the importance of having in-office treatments. There are just too many patients that come in and say, I'm not compliant. They don't say that word, but I just can't keep up with doing the things at home. Is there something you could just do here? And that's why I think as you establish these clinics and focus on dry, it's so important to have the technologies that someone's kind of been talking about today, because they're looking for that. And it can be done, you know, in office with expression. It doesn't require a lot of tools, as you know, pointed out. But I do think having something more, because it's not, you know, instilled at such a young age to make it habitual, we have to have more options for our patients. Also why having a drop is going to be valuable within our armamentarium.
Speaking of instilling it at a young age, you know, I think about now my kids who, you know, I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and teaching them how to brush their teeth and fighting over it, you know, every night. And, you know, you realize that somebody taught us how to brush teeth. And somebody sat down and somebody counseled us at some point. It was a parent. It's been passed down, but somebody taught that parent how to do that. And there are so many patients out there that something that seems simple, like, okay, I'm just going to clean up the lashes, it doesn't occur to patients. And I have patients all the time that ask me, exactly how am I supposed to do the warm compresses? And exactly how am I supposed to massage? And what are the directions? Where are the orifices and on the meibomian glands? And should I be using tea tree oil or a hypochlorous-based spray, or should I be using something that's sudsy, like a detergent? And, There's so many different options. It's so confusing, which speaks to the importance of really good training. And if you have the capacity to have somebody sit down and be an educator, so critical. If not, what I've done in my practice actually is I've just recorded myself giving a couple of different bits because I find myself saying the same stuff again. Okay. And, you know, if the patient asks, for example, you know, well, how am I supposed to do this? I go through the entire lid hygiene. I've got a few little ones. And I just say, I'm going to play a couple of things for you. And I'm going to come right back into the room and then you can ask me questions. And it just, it allows them to really think about it. And I think it builds compliance as well.
I would add, and I would echo what Raul just mentioned, education is key, and not only educate our patients, but really encourage them to follow through with these different measures. And what I tell them normally is like, let's be consistent with this regimen and let's reassess your symptoms in a set amount of time. And many times their experience can reinforce the benefits of these eyelid cleansers and these different measures for the treatment of dry eye.
I think you're right. If you can get them to stick with it, they're really going to see that they do get benefit from it. And then maybe that'll help with the compliance down the road. Well, I can't believe we're already getting to the end of our time together. Like we said, when we started this, I think we're probably going to go later than we anticipated because there's so much to talk about. And I still feel like there's so much more that I want to learn from all of you. But just to wrap up, I wonder, you know, we started this discussion about how sometimes these patients can be a little bit difficult to treat, or there was a bit of a hesitancy in accepting a lot of dry eye patients into your practice. And I think we all experienced that when we started. And it's something that we've all actually kind of gravitated towards. And so I wonder if you then have a tip, like what is your one biggest tip for seeing dry eye patients? And if I'll give you mine, mine is that I luckily have a dry eye educator who's with me on those specific dry eye days. And exactly as you were saying, to have somebody sit with a patient and show them exactly how to do an eyelid scrub or exactly how to do a compress or to put a drop in their eye has been a complete game changer for the practice. And the patients really appreciate it as well because they do need that hand-holding education. This is something so new for them. So from all of you, I'd love just like one quick tip that has really changed your dry eye practice.
I think giving the patients hope. Many of these patients have gone to multiple eye care providers and nobody's listened to them. So if they finally get to you and you say, I will be able to help you, but there is no cure. We have to become a team and we'll each do our part and kind of give them that pep talk saying that, yes, we will be able to help you, give them hope. And then they get inspired to follow your recommendations.
I love that.
I couldn't agree more with Cynthia that many times just listening makes a difference and letting them know that this is a complex disease, that not every dry eye patient is the same. So I'm here to listen to what's going on with you and how, and we'll figure out together as a team how to come up with a successful outcome at the end. I think education is key, like we already mentioned. Having a dry eye educator, I think, is a brilliant idea. And providing the patient with all this information, giving them the knowledge that there are all these different diagnostic tools and all these different therapeutic options for them so that they know that we can try different things and find what works best for them.
I like that too. I think, you know, you touched on education being so important, whether it's a photo you show of the collarettes or whatever's been mentioned tonight. Those are so important, the educator. I think the other thing though is you really have to simplify your diagnostics. You know, there's that old, you know, saying, I think it was Mark Twain that said, you know, if I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter. I remember in my career when I was testing 12, 13, 14 things, and no wonder our colleagues get so, you know, turned off by dry eye and how difficult it is. And, you know, today it's utilizing point of care diagnostics like osmolarity, like we talked about, or MP9. Then it's, you know, going through and directed questions would save a lot of time. It's, you know, putting in, you know, expressing the meibomian glands, looking at the lashes real carefully, maybe some fluorescein dye with a Rattan filter. You could see con staining and corneal staining. You could see tear meniscus. And you pretty much have your diagnosis. You know, it's that learning to get it simple enough that you can get through the patients then and spend more time with the education that so many others have described today.
Right. I'd say for us, it's lean in, slow down, look carefully, and
plan together with the patient. That's what it boils down to.
I love that. You can put that on a t-shirt.
I agree.
We should all get one.
What color should it be?
I agree with everything that's been said. And I'll just add, I think collaboration is so, so key. You know, for those that are treating dry eye, we have this thing in our head that we want to fix. And there's a cataract, it gets removed. Patient's seeing retinal detachment, it repairs, there's an anatomic success. And when we're not able to fix, or if a patient responds to something differently than we expected, and we can take it as a personal affront, we just become defensive about it. It's our nature. And it makes us feel like we want to run away from it. So we have to then, and I used to do this, that's why I feel like I'm speaking from experience. So instead of getting defensive, I'm turning the page, and I'm kind of going over, you know, even body posture. Uday Devgan taught me to come side by side with a patient and look at a study together. And it's so fascinating. You change the mix. That way the patient doesn't say, this is my dry eye and what are you doing for it? And how are you going to solve it? And oh, my eyes are not better. You've done something wrong. And if you do that, the patient's angry and you feel offended, and it breaks that bond. And that's why I think dry eye is not looked after well. If you collaborate and you say, look, this is a chronic condition. We're looking to get better control. We're trying to have you be less aware of your eyes. We are going to have, as scientific as we're attempting to make it, we're going to have some blips along the way. People are going to react to things differently. And I want my patients to come in and say, doctor, we tried this, but you know, it didn't work so well for us. And I'll say, okay, well, here are our other options. So becoming less paternalistic again with the dry eye care, simplifying things, you know, as Paul said, also allows us to incorporate those patients. And then being scientific to the extent that we can, and letting patients know that we care about them and there's hope. Good.
I just have one final thing to say. It's similar in vein to what everyone else has said. Frequent check-ins, whether it's a telemedicine visit or a follow-up, that way patients feel like they're not being abandoned. You're monitoring their improvements, that they don't have to, they know, oh, well, I'm having a flare, but I already have an appointment in just 3 days, in a week. So they know it's on the horizon. And I feel that it gives them a sense of security and trust in you, knowing that you're sort of holding their hand and you're checking up on them kind of frequently.
I love that. It seems like the bottom line to a lot of this is communication. I think that's a great skill for all of us as physicians, for all of us in life, even in communicating with our colleagues. And so I thank you all for being here. This is wonderful. As I mentioned, I could speak all night about this. So I really, really appreciate you giving your time and sharing all your wonderful advice as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you. That was super fun.
Thanks for listening to Dr. Brissett and the panel of experts as they provided some great insights into dry eye disease. For more expert commentary like this, as well as information from industry leaders and companies with important data to share, visit OIS.net to register for the upcoming OIS Anterior Innovation Showcase taking place on April 8th. We'll be back next week to bring you more innovative insights.